Hello, this is Melanie Guralnick, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 18th issue of the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first story is National Treasure Don Cherry Boosts Hockey Night in Brampton by Joe Warmington. Although he's retired from going to the rink for hockey games, it's safe to say that when it comes to the famous annual charity hockey game, Brampton has the coach in its corner. And so does the William Osler Health System. "I'm glad to do it," Don Cherry said Tuesday after receiving a visit from Hockey Night in Brampton organizers. At 92, he's happy to help the local hospital. Saying he wanted to do his part, Cherry invited Brampton Mayor Patrick Brown and fellow organizer Megan Guerra for a coffee and a photo shoot to be used on the Jumbotron at the CAA Center on game night. "I know he's going to get huge applause," Brown said. "He's a national treasure, and people want him to know how they feel about him." The mayor had talked to Cherry's son Tim about the idea of grapes coming into the game, which features NHL stars and alumni and has raised millions for the hospital. But Don still gets so many requests and made the decision last year to retire from public life, which included his popular Don Cherry's Grapevine podcast, which he did since leaving Hockey Night in Canada and Rogers in 2019. That said, he still likes to help when he can, particularly charities for Peel Regional Police and for hospitals. "The guy has done so much," Brown said. "He's such a legend." So many legends in this game. This game is filled with other legends as well. Mark Messier is coming out of retirement to play the current NHLers, Brown said on Tuesday. Fellow Edmonton Oilers icon Paul Coffey, too, as well as Leafs goaltending great Curtis Joseph, and former NHL stars Ryan Getzlaf, and current players like Dylan Strome and Owen Power, and Morgan Riley, as Team Riley squares off against Team Messier. "It's going to be a blast," Brown said. "Everybody is very excited." Tickets are $36 and can be purchased at hockeynightinbrampton.ca. While Don said he's enjoying the Toronto Blue Jays right now, trying to take a run at the postseason, at this time of year, hockey people started thinking about training camp. He may have more to say about that when it gets closer. While he isn't on the airwaves anymore, I've been trying to twist Tim Cherry's arm to jump in and take the lead in the podcast again, with him serving as the main voice. Like his dad, Tim knows hockey inside and out. A former OHL scout, he has been to more hockey games than most has, and has so many stories from his dad's Boston Bruins days when, as a kid of the coach, he was like a fly on the wall for all of it. Always exciting to see Don Cherry. Hopefully it happens, and maybe he could get some guest appearances from Don as well. "It's always exciting to see Don," said Brown, who added, "Everybody who grew up on Coach's Corner feels the same way." It's true. And many are trying to right the wrong of how he was treated by Rogers on Remembrance Day in 2019. Premier Doug Ford dropped by this year to give the coach the Order of Ontario, and many are still working behind the scenes to get him the Order of Canada and into the Hockey Hall of Fame as a broadcaster or builder. It's hard to imagine any Canadian or anybody in hockey who has had more impact than Don Cherry. Brown said that's why he wanted to make sure the coach is honored at this game Wednesday. Dine and Dasher picked the wrong restaurant to skip out on. If you are going to do a dine and dash, it may be a good idea to choose a restaurant not named after Don Cherry. You might end up in a tussle and the penalty box. Or, so a man found out at the Don Cherry Sports Grill in Parry Sound on the weekend. Quote, "A man enjoyed his meal, skipped the bill, and took off," the restaurant posted on its Facebook page. "We literally chased him down." He didn't see that coming. The OPP came to the assistance and took a man into custody. The matter is still under investigation, but one thing is for certain. Angela, a server with 25 years' experience, didn't get the tip coming to her. Quote, "Eat, drink, and be cherry," teased the restaurant. "And don't walk out on your bill." Certainly not at a place named after a hockey guy known for being someone who shouldn't be messed with. There is a picture of Don Cherry and Brampton Mayor Patrick Brown, and they are apparently gearing up for hockey night in Brampton. And Don Cherry is sitting in a wicker chair with a thumbs up. He's an older guy with white hair. He's got a beard and mustache. And he's holding onto a red t-shirt that says Hockey Nights, Brampton in white. And then on the other side, the shirt's being held up by Mayor Patrick Brown. And he looks to be like late 40s, good-looking guy, and he's also doing a thumbs up. Photo credit goes to Joe Warmington via the Toronto Sun. That story was National Treasure Don Cherry Boosts Hockey Night in Brampton by Joe Warmington. The next story is, did Amanda Anisimova drink a beer during tennis match against Alexandra Iala? By Dan Balicki. It was a hot and humid night at the Cincinnati Masters tennis tournament on Monday. So, what better time to enjoy a nice cool beer at the match? Sure, that's all fine and good if you're a fan in the stands, but it certainly draws attention when you're one of the players involved in a close contest. During a break in play in her round of 32 matchup against Alexandra Iala, Amanda Anisimova was spotted sitting down and having a drink out of a plastic cup. What was Amanda Anisimova drinking? Tennis fans and the commentators were left puzzled, though, as the drink certainly wasn't water and didn't appear to be a sports drink of any sort. In fact, it looked remarkably like beer. After noticing the odd choice of drink, Brett Haber asked fellow broadcaster Lindsay Davenport if she knew what Anisimova's beverage of choice was. Could it be apple cider, Brett? Davenport asked. I mean, I would never suggest that a player was drinking a beer in the middle of a match, but that's certainly what it looked like, Haber said. I've never seen that, Davenport added. It could be non-alcoholic. It could be cider. It could be anything. We don't know, Haber said, as the action on the court resumed. According to WTA Tour rules, consuming alcohol during a match is strictly prohibited under player code of conduct and professionalism guidelines. During the third set, Haber returned to the subject and put fans' minds at ease, confirming that Anisimova had been drinking a Red Bull. We can confirm via one of our courtside camera operators that Anisimova asked for and was delivered a Red Bull. That is the mystery, Bevy, he said. Did the drink help? It appears that seeing the Red Bull poured into a clear plastic cup threw many for a loop, as most fans would have expected to see it consumed out of the brand's trademark bull and silver cans. However, due to WTA Tour advertising and branding rules, the cans aren't allowed to be used. With temperatures hovering around 26 degrees Celsius in Cincinnati on Monday night, and the humidity at a staggering 91-94%, the drink might have been just what Anisimova needed. After losing the first set to the Philippine sensation 6-4, the American won the second and third sets 6-4 and 6-2 to advance to round of 16. Anisimova, who is ranked number 10 in the world, will take on the 8th-ranked Linda Noskova of Czechia on Wednesday. There is a picture of Amanda Anisimova, and it's a super extreme close-up. And she's got that plastic cup to her mouth. You can see her blue eyes as she's looking up. And dang, if that doesn't look just like beer, like it has like little foam and everything. It's the exact same color of like that golden. Wow, okay, I see why people got that. Photo courtesy of Twitter. That story was, did Amanda Anisimova drink a beer during tennis match against Alexandra Ayala? By Dan Balicki. The next story is Canadian home sales climb for fourth consecutive month, by Brian Towey. Home sales are ticking up again. The number of homes sold on Canadian MLS systems went up 0.5% on a month-over-month basis in July, marking the fourth month in a row of gains, according to the Canadian Real Estate Association, or CREA. Return to balance. As home sales climbed, listings continued to tighten up. New listings declined by 1.6% on a month-over-month basis, the third drop in a row. The sales-to-new listing ratio also tightened to 51.3% from 50.2%. It's all part of the market coming back into balance, says Gary Bahara, CREA chair, and that the cool down of the buyer's market might actually help house shoppers in the long run. Quote, the ongoing shift toward a more normal balance between supply and demand in so many markets across Canada is good news for buyers, whether that means not having to worry about your new home falling in value or not feeling pressured to make a decision due to competing offers, said Gary Bahara, CREA chair. No matter where you are in Canada, more moderate housing market conditions can be expected to continue to bring buyers off the sidelines going forward. Housing markets in the Prairies, Quebec, and the East Coast have shifted from seller's markets, according to CREA senior economist Sean Cathcart. More recently, the hottest housing markets, BC's Lower Mainland and Ontario's Golden Horseshoe, have moved from buyer's markets back into balance. Inventory holding. There were 205,388 properties listed for sale across Canadian MLS systems by the end of July, only up 0.6% from a year earlier and 1.5% above the long-term seasonal average. Inventory has held close to that level for more than a year now, CREA said. Months of inventory came in at 4.7 across the country, 2026 lowest reading so far, and just under a long-term average of 5 months. CREA defines a seller's market as below 3.6 months of inventory, and a buyer's market as above 6.4. That story was Canadian Home Sales Climb for Fourth Consecutive Month, by Brian Towey. The next story is Who is Michaela Demeter? Quote, world's sexiest hockey player linked to dating Bryson DeChambeau, by Dan Balicki. If there's one thing that Bryson DeChambeau has always been good at, it's getting golf fans talking, both for his play on the course and what he does off of it. But for all the attention the LIV Golf star typically garners, rarely has the talk been about his rumored romantic endeavors. That has now changed, and for good reason. Rumors suggest that DeChambeau has become involved with Michaela Demeter, a retired Canadian goalie turned influencer and OnlyFans model, who has been dubbed the world's sexiest hockey player by many on social media. How did the rumors begin? Whispers about a potential relationship between DeChambeau and Demeter began earlier this month, when she began posting photos on social media while attending LIV Golf's tournament at Trump National Golf Club Bedminster. Demeter posted several photos from the event while wearing a lanyard and guest pass badge around her neck, which stated that she was a player guest, and listed the team as Crushers GC, which DeChambeau captains. The intrigue was only dialed up further when Demeter shared photos of herself from what appeared to be DeChambeau's home gym, with users on social media quick to point out that the equipment bared the golfer's personal logo. Quote, here to make everyone forget what they're doing, she captioned the photo on X. She also posted selfies from what appeared to be DeChambeau's closet, with dozens of pairs of shoes in the background. DeChambeau is one of Demeter's 3 million followers on Instagram and reportedly has been single for a few years. His most recent public relationship was with Hunter Nugent, a former golf player at the University of Texas. The pair reportedly split in September 2022, and he has stayed out of the spotlight romantically since then. How was Demeter's hockey career? The Chatham, Ontario-born beauty was forced to retire from hockey in 2019 at just 19 years old due to a knee injury. She announced her retirement with an emotional message on social media, saying that it was, quote, time to turn the page and move to the next chapter. During her unfortunately brief career on the ice, the 5'4" Demeter played goaltender for the Blue Water Hawks in Canada's Provincial Women's Hockey League. She played in 20 games during the 2018 through 19 season, notching a record of 5.11.0 with a goals against average of 2.25 and a save percentage of .909. She also had 3 shutouts. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Since joining OnlyFans, Demeter has racked up more than 1.3 million likes on the racy photo site. She also has been active on TikTok, where she has 2.7 million followers, and has seen her posts collect almost 28 million total likes. In one of her clips, Demeter describes what she's looking for in a potential suitor, including a love for hockey, dogs, the outdoors, and golf, complete with photo of herself teeing up a shot at the driving range. What's next for Bryson DeChambeau? But while DeChambeau hasn't confirmed or denied the rumors involving himself and the blonde beauty, he has set up some plans for the future. The golf star has been confirmed to be playing in the Ned Bank Golf Challenge later this year, an event hosted by Gary Player in South Africa. Quote, I am absolutely delighted that Bryson will compete in this year's Ned Bank Golf Challenge, Player posted on his Instagram. The South African crowds loved watching him play earlier this year, and it is wonderful to welcome him back to our incredible country. The tournament runs from December 3rd through the 6th, later this year, and was previously known as the Million Dollar Challenge. There is no word yet if Demeter has booked a ticket of her own to Sun City, but fans surely will have their eye out for her. There is an undated picture of Michaela Demeter. Oh my gosh. So Dolly Parton would look flat as a board compared to her because she has the biggest chest and the smallest waist. And then she's wearing, I don't know if it's some like the pants you wear as the goalie. So they're these big black pants and she's wearing a super skin tight white tank top. And you could see the black bra strap underneath and lots of cleavage. Like, I think her back's going to break looking at her. Anyway, she's like moved forward with her chest. She's got one hand on her behind and then her other hand is holding a hockey stick. And on top of that, she's super gorgeous, has blue eyes, blonde hair, and then these very large lips. Photo courtesy of Michaela Demeter via Instagram. That story was, who is Michaela Demeter? World's Sexiest Hockey Player Linked to Dating Bryson DeChambeau by Dan Balicki. The next story is Canadians Paying More for Day-to-Day Expenses as New Tariffs Loom by Brian Towey. Canadians might have to tighten their belts yet again as grocery prices climb and the country braces for more U.S. tariffs starting Wednesday. Inflation rates may be holding steady, according to new data, but grocery prices rose 3.1% year over year, the 18th consecutive month that grocery inflation outpaced overall inflation. And it could get worse. The U.S. is set to impose 50% tariffs on almost $20 billion worth of Canadian goods should the two countries not reach a trade deal by August 19th. They target Canadian dairy products, alcohol, auto parts, honey, cement, furniture, and hockey sticks. Americans get hit by those tariffs first, of course. But experts say U.S. companies might try to recoup their money by making products they export to Canada more expensive to buy. John Boscarial, co-leader and partner in the International Trade and Investment Group at McCarthy Tétrault, told Global News that products that cross the border multiple times while they're being manufactured, such as auto parts and vehicles, could become indirectly more expensive for Canadians due to the added cost of border tariffs. New tariffs on plastic could have a profound impact, experts add, as it affects electronics, machinery parts, bottles, and so much more. Canadians take the hit. Higher costs due to new tariffs would come at a bad time for Canadians, who are already feeling the financial squeeze. According to recent studies, half the country says the money they make doesn't keep pace with inflation. And 51% are cutting back on discretionary spending, like dining out and travel, for example, to help make ends meet. Worse yet, 29% of Canadians are using more credit than they were last year for essentials, such as groceries and utilities. And 23% are dipping into their savings to cover day-to-day expenses. 1 in 4 Canadians are only making the minimum payment on their credit cards, while 7% expect to fall behind in payments. Canadians are increasingly in deeper financial trouble, too. 37,523 filed for consumer insolvency in the second quarter of 2026, up 7% year over year and the highest quarterly level in 15 years. Mortgage arrears are on the rise too, at 40,912, up from 33,393 last year. That story was Canadians Paying More for Day-to-Day Expenses as New Tariffs Loom, by Brian Towey. The next story is What's Wrong with Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? Joey Votto Has a Theory, by Rob Longley. Is there a World Series hangover dragging Vladimir Guerrero Jr. down? Is the weight of the 14-year contract signed early in the 2025 season making it more difficult to snap out of a season-long funk? And what technical glitches are conspiring to make the Blue Jays' six-time All-Star first baseman from having the worst offensive season of his career? Quote, year one of a 14-year contract, he has to perform better, Votto said on the MLB Network on Tuesday, referring to the 2026 season being the first of Guerrero's mammoth $500 million U.S. deal. Quote, and he knows that. There has to be more home runs, and that comes from swing efficiency. And technically, there is something off. Votto, who grew up in Etobicoke and is now retired after his stellar career with the Cincinnati Reds, believes there are a number of factors that could be weighing on Guerrero, who has yet to hit a homer in Toronto this season and has just 7 overall. Though Guerrero is currently on the injured list with a concussion sustained this past Friday, the Jays are hoping that when he returns, he'll finally be able to unlock the missing power that has hampered the team's attack. Is there a World Series hangover? Votto, who has transitioned into the broadcasting world in his retirement, was a keen observer of his hometown team during last autumn's World Series run, and certainly was captivated with Guerrero's impact. But now he wonders about the fallout of that success, one that has led to massive expectations for Guerrero to have the season of his life. My question is there some sort of hangover from the World Series? Votto said. And the other thing I want to say is, from age 26 to 27, in my experience, my bat slowed, and I'm wondering if technically Vladdy has the ability to adjust and simplify a swing because he's been handed this till 40 years old contract. With that contract comes immense responsibility, as Votto knows. When he was in the midst of his superstardom with the Reds, Votto signed a 12-year, $251 million contract with the Reds, which at the time was the longest guaranteed contract in the sport. Quote, "You know, when you get handed a 10-plus year contract, it's an immense responsibility for two reasons," Votto explained on MLB Network. "First of all, obviously the relationship with the team, but you also have to think big picture. How do I perform with excellence at year 5, at year 8, at year 10? What's technically wrong with Vladdy? Votto was known as a studious hitter during his terrific career and makes it clear something is off with Vlad. Quote, "There's something going on technically, obviously," Votto said. "If the ball's not going over the fence, clearly it's showing up." The Etobicoke native attempted to explain it in a post on X earlier this week. Quote, "Watching the Blue Jays game, Vladdy's just not back-legging or back-hipping balls," Votto wrote on his post. "His forward move is delaying his barrel from snapping in place. He sees the ball, knows it's drivable, but his move causes the bat to lag. Keeps him from getting the barrel to the target. Agree?" Question mark. While Blue Jays hitting coaches no doubt have their own theories, there's certainly a consensus that something is off with the player expected to drive the offense. As the lack of production has taken deeper roots, the frustration continues to grow for Guerrero. Does kinder, gentler Toronto help? Though there have been a smattering of boos at the Rogers Center on some of the more unsightly Guerrero at-bats, it's nothing like what Vlad would be hearing in more, shall we say, boisterous markets. Like Philadelphia, for example. Quote, "The fans, they love him there," Votto said. "The Toronto fan base is a great fan base in that they're going to show up, but they don't have the feel that a Philadelphia or a Mets fan base has in terms of letting their superstars know immediately that we expect production right now." There is a picture of Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and he is on the ball field. He's in the white Blue Jays uniform that says Blue Jays in blue and a Nike symbol on the front. He's wearing blue gloves, and he's taken off his ball cap. He's an African-Canadian, I guess. I'm sorry. And he's wearing like a big diamond earring, and he's got short black hair and a kind of thick beard and a mustache. And he's posing with his hand on the bat and the other hand on his hip. And the crowd behind him is kind of out of focus. Photo courtesy of Getty Images. That story was What's Wrong with Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? Joey Votto Has a Theory by Rob Longley. The next story is Caitlin Clark and Sophie Cunningham Try Uniquely Canadian Cuisine by Gordon Anderson. Prior to Tuesday night's WNBA matchup between the Toronto Tempo and Indiana Fever, Sophie Cunningham, Caitlin Clark, and Lexi Hull spent a night out on the town, sharing a uniquely Canadian theme with their fans. After a dinner somewhere in downtown Toronto, their waitress supplied them with a Canadian-style care package, consisting of chips, chocolate, cookies, ginger ale, and gummy bears. The comrades-in-arms spent more than 7 minutes on TikTok expressing varied opinions on these sweet and savory snacks, mixed in with playful, back-and-forth banter that teammates and friends know well. Quote, "We are back to try some Canadian snacks, eh?" said Cunningham, uttering the time-tested, worn-out cliché into the camera. The outspoken Cunningham began the dissection with a bag of ketchup chips. "They smell horrible," Clark offers as the bag rips open quietly at the seams. "They taste like barbecue chips, but I don't like the aftertaste," Cunningham said. Clark then shakes her head side to side 2 times with a heavy frown on her face. "Who is eating these?" she said off camera. "I didn't like the aftertaste," Cunningham says again. Clark then pulls the camera toward herself and doubles down. "Who is eating these?" "Canadians," Hall replies. After mostly negative reactions to the ketchup chips, the all-dressed flavor was next on the hit list. "I like these," says Cunningham. 10 out of 10. "These are better," Clark added. Inexhaustible bag of goods. From the pit of what seemed like a bottomless grocery bag, the teammates then sampled a coffee crisp, maple cookies, a bottle of Canadian-made ginger beer, and a bag of gummy bears. Both Clark and Cunningham enjoyed the chocolate bar. Hull was nervous before taking her first bite. "Oh my God," she said, not in the affirmative way. Finally, at the end of this particular rainbow, there was one product they all agreed on. "These are the best ones," they said about the gummy bears. In the end, the all-dressed chips and the gummy bears won over the hearts of the three Americans. And that is only because they didn't try milk from a bag or poutine. That story was Caitlin Clark and Sophie Cunningham Try Uniquely Canadian Cuisine by Gordon Anderson. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next story is "Was Hockey Cut from Weston Arena Because of White Privilege?" by Justin Holmes. When Toronto City Hall made plans to reinvent a historic arena without hockey, the local councillor was reportedly telling the public that the sport is white privilege. Documents show that last fall, a member of the public demanded a copy of the lease for Weston Lions Arena following an apparent threat to warn major hockey organizations about Councillor Francis Nunziata's white privilege remark. At the time, it appeared the arena would no longer host hockey in its next life as an MLSE launchpad facility. While Nunziata announced this year that hockey will still have a home at the arena, it appears the Weston facility won't reopen for this upcoming season. The councillor's office did not respond to requests for comment, but a number of sources close to the arena told the Toronto Sun that they either heard Nunziata call hockey white privilege or had heard complaints about her making the remark during meetings. Sandy Ross served as chairman of the board of the arena until the city ended the Weston Lions lease this spring. He told the Sun he had heard Nunziata make the white privilege comment more than once last year. "I'm sure she said it to many other people," Ross said. "I had a million conversations with her previously. I do know that she said that as a fact." Quite taken aback. The Sun was provided a 451-page document full of City of Toronto emails obtained via a Freedom of Information request. The document was provided by Daniel Tate, who had advocated for a future for hockey at the Weston Arena with his Integrity TO group, but is now running for City Council in a downtown ward. An email chain contained in those documents claims Nunziata made the white privilege remark, but critical details, including who sent and got most of the emails, have been blacked out. The Sun has asked sources in the arena community about the emails, but cannot confirm who is behind them. The initial email was sent on September 26, 2025, shortly after a presentation to the public about the MLSC launchpad concept. The MLSC Foundation ignored a request for comment. Quote, "I had conversations with a few attendees prior to the MLSC presentation. During one of those conversations, I was quite taken aback to hear that Councillor Nunziata had reportedly made comments to a group suggesting that hockey is white privilege," the email says. Days later, on October 1, that email was forwarded to Nunziata's office. Quote, "Several people were not happy with the comments below. And I know that Hockey Canada and MLSC would also not be happy hearing these comments, an associated email says. I would kindly ask that an apology be given regarding these comments. 2 days later, an email was sent to Nunziata's office, asking her to kindly forward a copy of the lease for the 76-year-old arena. That last email drew a reaction, as Marilyn McCree, a consultant in Nunziata's office who has ties to a local developer, asked a bureaucrat in the city's Parks and Rec division for advice on a response. No reply email from the parks official exists in the documents. It's unclear why McCree handled this matter and why she consulted a parks official. In a statement, the City of Toronto said it cannot comment on communications regarding elected officials and complaints received by their offices. Hold off on contacting Lions. The Freedom of Information request had asked for all correspondence last year to or from the Parks Division and Nunziata's office that mentioned the arena. The emails show how the arena's operators ties to City Hall frayed, with the Weston Lions at times deliberately kept out of the loop. In late March 2025, an arena staffer was asked by Parks and Rec to provide a weekly ice schedule for the city's ice facility strategy. The Weston Lions declined to provide it, an email from early April shows. However, that same week, park officials were working with Nunziata's office on a motion for that month's city council meeting, which directed bureaucrats to, quote, engage with the MLSC Foundation on reimagining Weston Lions Arena. The plans that later took shape were for a sports-centered community space that would not include hockey. Quote, we heard that the Weston Lions are struggling with uptake of programs and registrations, a Parks and Rec official wrote Nunziata's office on April 10th. In advance of the motion coming forward, we'd like to speak with the Lions directly to better understand where they are at on the issues at play. An hour later, that official wrote back to thank Gino Orsi of Nunziata's office for a phone call. Quote, we will hold off on contacting the Lions for now, understanding the councillor wants to speak with them once the motion is drafted, the parks official wrote. Ross and others have told The Sun that the arena's ice time and programs were always in demand. In its statement, the city denied the request for an ice schedule was a ruse, saying its ice facility strategy work began in late 2024 as part of a 5-year process. Councillors' untruths. The Weston Lions' relationship with City Hall only worsened. In an email to Parks and Rec officials in November 2025, Ross said, in light of a recent meeting of Mayor Olivia Chow's executive committee, his group had, quote, decided to withdraw our cooperation to the City of Toronto. Quote, we will be happy to let you know where the keys are at the end of March, he wrote. Ross told The Sun that after a few months dealing with City Hall, he got increasingly the feeling he was being played. Then, that November committee meeting, Nunziata told, quote, untruths, including about his health, he said. At the meeting, she said Ross and the Lions had pleaded with the city to get them out of the lease. She told Stephen Holliday, a critic of the arena closure who represents a neighboring ward, quote, they wanted out. Councillor Holliday, that's why I said you don't understand. That drew chuckles from members of the committee. Outraged, Ross called her, and he said Nunziata apologized for overstepping. A week later, City Council passed a motion from Nunziata and Chow titled, quote, expressing gratitude to the Weston Lions Club. Ross, however, said his phone call served as the last word. I haven't spoken to her since, actually, he said. There is a picture of the 76-year-old Weston Lions Arena, and it's just basically a rectangular building. The bottom half of it is like a a concrete color, like a light sandy color. And then the upper half is like a red brick. And there are five batches of square windows across the top. Photo courtesy of Sunfiles. That story was hockey cut from Weston Arena because of white privilege? By Justin Holmes. The next story is patch-wearing Hell's Angels turn up at London, Ontario restaurants as biker rivalry grows. By Dale Carruthers. His motorcycle helmet, bearing the letters AFFA, Angels Forever, comma, Forever Angels, is perched atop his Harley-Davidson, decorated with the Outlaw Biker Club's Death Head logo, just meters away. Just a few weeks earlier, nearly a dozen men wearing Hell's Angels patches, leather vests bearing the club's logo and chapter location, dined together at a South London steakhouse. The presence of patch-wearing bikers at both restaurants unnerved some fellow customers and drew criticism from an organized crime expert. Quote, "It's all intimidation and flex. Should we allow it? Not at all," said Paul Derry, an author and speaker on organized crime, of wearing outlaw biker gear in bars and restaurants. Why should we allow them to put more of their propaganda out there and intimidate people? While it's not illegal to wear outlaw biker patches and support gear, police in several Ontario cities have launched programs targeting individuals sporting it in public places. Police in participating cities provide signs reading, quote, "No gang colors, no gang clothing," to local businesses and say that the policy is enforced through the Trespass to Property Act. Businesses are instructed to call police to remove patrons who violate the rule. In Sarnia, where an alleged member of the Outlaws was arrested after trying to lay a black and white wreath at the cenotaph during a Remembrance Day ceremony 2 years ago, police went a step further, placing signs in a public park prohibiting gang colors and clothing. The OPP-led Biker Enforcement Unit works with bars and restaurants frequented by outlaw bikers to ensure property owners know their rights, including the right to refuse service, said OPP Detective Superintendent Andrew Bradford of the Organized Crime Enforcement Bureau. Quote, "The presence of motorcycle gangs in any community should be a concern," Bradford said in a statement. "Citizens should limit contact with gang members and report any outlaw motorcycle gang activity to the OPP or the police service of jurisdiction in their community." The owner of the Old South restaurant declined to comment, while the South End Steakhouse didn't respond to a request for comment. Derry, whose work as a paid RCMP informant for nearly two decades led to the convictions of dozens of people, including Hell's Angels members, said bikers will be on their best behavior while in public places, but their rivals will get the message. Quote, "To those that don't know what's going on, they're going to be intimidated," he said. "So you have both things going on at the same time." Derry said the Hell's Angels in London are clearly sending a message to Satan's choice. Quote, "They're just flexing their colors right now. They're making sure Satan's choice knows this is their territory, and they're going to have a presence," he said of the Hell's Angels, the world's largest outlaw biker club. "And you're going to see that right across Canada." Satan's Choice opened a London chapter, the club's third in southwestern Ontario, in the spring as part of its rapid expansion across Canada. The London chapter has around 20 members, including former Hell's Angels National President Harley Gwinden previously told the Free Press. Located along the 400 series highway corridor between Toronto and Detroit, London is considered important territory for outlaw motorcycle clubs and has been the site of violent clashes between rivals. The Hell's Angels are the dominant club in the city, with about a dozen full-patch members and two support clubs, the Gatekeepers and One Order. Gwyndon, a former Hell's Angel member who runs a print shop in Oshawa, revived the club his father helped launch decades ago. Since relaunching Satan's Choice last year, the club has opened 50 chapters across Canada and others in the United States, Asia, and Europe. There is a picture of a motorcycle guy. He's standing next to the top of a motorcycle. I can't tell what type it is. And he's wearing a black leather vest over a black t-shirt. And this is taken from behind him. So at the top of the vest, it says Hell's Angels in red lettering. Underneath it, Ontario. And in the middle of it, there's like a gold wing that's stretched out. And in the front of it is a skull face. He's also wearing a helmet that is black with the same wings on both sides, and it says AFFA underneath that. And the guy is facing a crowd of bikers, and they're really out of focus for this picture. Photo courtesy of Dale Carruthers, the London Free Press. That story was patch-wearing Hell's Angels turn up at London, Ontario restaurants as biker rivalry grows, by Dale Carruthers. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next story is Booze, Autos, and a Midnight Deadline, Inside Canada's Tariff Standoff, by Brian Lilly. Canada's political class hunkered down on Tuesday, preparing for what would come out of Washington. A potential 50% tariff on billions of dollars of Canadian exports. Throughout the day, CBC and CTV's news channels carried nonstop coverage of the tariff issue, examining it from every angle. On CNN and Fox, not a mention. As we obsess over the tariff issue, the Americans are barely noticing. Sure, the business media in the United States is paying attention. Josh Wingrove, who covers the White House for Bloomberg, noted on Tuesday afternoon that the White House was downplaying any possibility of a deal. Still, a proposal was put on Trump's desk late in the day. The price of a deal. The Americans have been demanding that any lessening of the tariffs be met with an immediate end to provincial booze bans. Note that the demand is to put the booze back on the shelves in exchange for lower tariffs, not the lifting of tariffs. That will be very difficult for Premier Doug Ford in Ontario, Premier Christine Freshette in Quebec, and Premier David Eby in British Columbia. All three have vowed to keep their respective booze bans in place while their industries are targeted by tariffs. It seems unlikely, though, that the Americans will fully lift tariffs on steel, aluminum, autos, and lumber. The Americans don't even want to discuss lumber at the moment. The Commerce Department in Washington is in the middle of a review of Canadian lumber practices, and that won't be complete until at least the fall. The Americans are highly unlikely to drop their tariffs on steel and aluminum. Last week, Trump's top trade negotiator, Jamieson Greer, was praising tariffs, calling them a success story for America's steel industry. Quote, "Last year we actually shipped more steel than Japan for the first time in decades. So this is working. We have new steel factories coming up. We have steel jobs expanding," Greer said. Autos and booze. The real sticking point, though, is autos and booze. If we get a fair deal that will protect our steel sector, our auto sector, our forestry sector, agricultural sector, manufacturing sector, then we'd be more than happy to bring booze back on the shelf, Premier Ford said last week. As talks continued Tuesday, Reuters was reporting that the Americans had offered to reduce the auto tariffs from 25% to 15%. Will Doug Ford consider a drop to a 15% tariff on autos to be a fair deal? Most likely not. While the Americans are upset about the booze ban in eight provinces, Alberta and Saskatchewan ended their bans in 2025, Ontario is the main concern. The province's liquor authority, the LCBO, is the largest purchaser of beverage alcohol in the world. Producers of California wines and Kentucky bourbon have been lobbying hard to find a resolution that would see their products return to the Canadian market. Unless Prime Minister Mark Carney pressures Ford to accept terms that are less than stellar, a 15% tariff won't cut it. There are ways to adjust the tariffs, tighten rules of origin, and increase American content requirements in Canadian-made vehicles that could get the effective tariff rate down to single digits. But even accepting that would signal the beginning of the end for one of Ontario's largest industries. The midnight deadline. If a deal isn't reached, then at midnight, the United States would be imposing 50% tariffs on $28 billion of Canadian goods. Everything from hockey sticks to cement, alcohol to honey. The list of products facing tariffs isn't random. The Americans spent months examining the Canadian economy and selected products that would cause political pain in this country. Carney was scheduled to talk to Trump before the midnight deadline. Getting a reprieve isn't impossible, but, to be blunt, Carney is in a very difficult spot. That story was Booze, Autos, and a Midnight Deadline, Inside Canada's Tariff Standoff, by Brian Lilly. The next story is Third Set of Human Remains Uncovered at Smiths Falls Property, by Nicholas Kohler. Police have located a third set of human remains on a densely wooded property outside of Smiths Falls. The remains have been identified as belonging to Lawrence Bertram, who was 42 years old when he was last seen in downtown Smiths Falls on September 30, 2022. A cause of death has not been determined and charges have not yet been laid, police said. The discovery is the latest strange revelation for Smiths Falls, a town southwest of Ottawa that in recent years has struggled to understand the disappearance of three men from the area, all of whom have now been traced back to a single parcel of land. "We're sad. We know now he's gone. But we're happy he's coming home," said Bertram's mother, Lyndall Mindel, who helped lead an active four-year campaign to locate her missing son. Quote, "As a parent, I get to bury my child now, which hurts. But I'm happy that I'm not going to my grave not knowing where he is." OPP Sergeant Aaron Cranton said investigators found Bertram's remains on August 6th. That means his discovery came a day after police found the remains of Robert Lambert on the same property, located at 572 Kelly Jordan Road in Montague Township west of Highway 15. Lambert was 75 when he was last seen in the summer of 2018. He had been an owner of the 40-acre Kelly Jordan Road property, and his remains were long suspected of being interred somewhere amid the thickly growing trees there. Bertram's connection to the address is unknown. Sergeant Cranton, meanwhile, confirmed no charges have been laid in connection to Lambert's death. Quote, "We understand there is concern from the public, as this is the third set of human remains located on the property on Kelly Jordan Road," Sergeant Cranton said in a video statement. The OPP Criminal Investigation Branch has been searching the property, save for a hiatus over winter, since October, when they located the remains of another missing man, Robbie Thompson, 34. OPP has not yet located Thompson's body before they arrested three people in connection to his death. Charged with first-degree murder are Christopher Philip Fenton, 48, Aaron Lynn Mackey, 41, and Joshua Joseph Belfiore, 35, of Bath, Ontario. A fourth person, 42-year-old Mark Fenton, was arrested in April and charged with accessory after the fact to murder in connection with Thompson's death. Mark Fenton was released on bail in July. Mackey was denied bail in March. Christopher Fenton and Mackey were both listed on the police charge sheet as living at the Kelly Jordan property at the time of their arrests. The disappearance over recent years of Thompson, Lambert, and Bertram, all from the Smiths Falls area, led many in the small community to believe the men's cases are linked. A fourth man who locals frequently connect with the disappearances, Stephen Tate, 34, was last seen alive on November 4, 2023. His body turned up some days later at the side of Highway 15, not far from Kelly Jordan Road. Police long maintained they had no evidence linking the four men. They say Tate was the victim of a hit and run and have released images and video of a car they say may have been involved. A familiar figure around downtown Smiths Falls, Bertram was the oldest of four siblings and the father of two daughters. He has long struggled with drugs and alcohol. Mindel said investigators informed Bertram's family on Sunday they had uncovered his remains. But Mindel added that as recently as April, when she last spoke to police, the probe into his vanishing appeared to be at a standstill. Quote, "There was no inkling that they even suspected where he was or anything," she said, adding, "And where he was found is like baffling to us because the people that lived there, their names don't mean anything to us. They never have. It was like, who are they?" The Friday Bertram went missing, according to his mother, he told his roommate on the phone that he did not feel safe. He was calling from a house on Church Street West and was afraid to leave the property. It was the last place he was seen alive. That story was Third Set of Human Remains Uncovered at Smiths Falls Property by Nicholas Kohler. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 18th issue of the Toronto Sun. Your reader has been Melanie Guralnick. Thank you for listening.